Welcome to the podcast of Media Matters with Bob McChesney, a weekly show on media from WILL Radio. Visit us at will.uiuc.edu.
Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today in WILL AM 580 from beautiful Urbana, Illinois. It's my pleasure today to have as our guest, one of our favorite guests here on Media Matters, one of the leading authors and essayists in the United States today and for many years now, to talk about her new book, Dancing in the Streets. Our guest will be Barbara Ehrenreich, live on the phones with us. So sit back, relax, have a great show, but first let's go to Media Minutes.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news relating to the intersection of media and democracy. I'm John Anderson.
And I'm Kimberly Cronick.
The U.S. Department of Justice, in large part thanks to Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez, is seeking broad new powers to prosecute people under copyright law. The Attorney General has submitted proposed legislation to Congress that would strengthen the already severe penalties imposed on those who knowingly duplicate and distribute copyrighted material, such as movies, music, and software. However, Gonzalez's proposal would also create a new category of crime, which can essentially be defined as attempted copyright infringement. That is, if someone tries to share copyrighted material with someone else and fails to do so, or uses an unauthorized copy of software that they might not even know was duplicated illegally, they could face heavy fines and imprisonment, in some cases even a sentence of life behind bars. What's worse, the Department of Justice's proposal also seeks to increase its already expansive authority to conduct wiretaps, this time against anyone suspected of infringing another's copyright. This would effectively allow federal law enforcement to put citizens under surveillance even if they have no reasonable suspicion that they may be engaged in what is essentially a victimless crime. In addition, the Department of Homeland Security would be directed to work in conjunction with the Recording Industry Association of America on cases where large-scale copyright infringement is suspected. This continues a trend of effectively farming out copyright law enforcement authority from a government ostensibly accountable to its citizens to a private industry.
The federal government makes new moves to blur the boundary between public relations and information warfare, while becoming more secretive to boot. The U.S. military already targets both foreign and domestic media to conduct propaganda operations in Iraq and elsewhere. Now, General David Petraeus, the commander-in-chief of the Iraq occupation, is asking the Pentagon for even more flexibility in how it conducts psychological operations. At many U.S. bases in Iraq, soldiers who fight the propaganda war and those who practice civilian media relations already work side by side. Meanwhile, the Department of Defense has banned access to sites like MySpace, YouTube, and several other streaming media portals throughout its global network, claiming operational security concerns. This while the Pentagon launches its own video channel on YouTube, which presumably nobody in the military will be allowed to watch. In addition, U.S. Army soldiers both abroad and at home are now prohibited from blogging about their experiences unless they get prior approval from a commanding officer. Failing to follow this restriction may result in a court-martial. Back in D.C., the White House has informed Congress that it's going to stray from a pledge to get its wiretaps of phone and internet traffic approved by a special court. After revelations last year that the National Security Agency was sifting through mountains of information on millions of people without the proper warrants, the Bush administration promised it would follow the law. However, national intelligence officials now claim that the president has constitutional authority to ignore the courts and continue illicit surveillance if he feels the circumstances call for it.
Companies that sell junk food, like candy, soda, sugary cereals, and fast food, are blazing new trails in the new media environment when it comes to targeting children with pitches for their products. New research from the Berkeley Media Studies Group details dozens of ways junk food pushers are enticing children and adolescents to, in many cases, extend the advertising process way beyond its traditional boundaries. These include the use of social networking and other sites like MySpace and YouTube to forge new relationships with kids, enlisting assisting them in some cases to make their own advertisements, and developing new interactive video games and cell phone systems like text messaging to both collect marketing information on children and recruit them to become mini marketers to their peers. It is unclear just how much junk food companies spend on these new media marketing efforts, and it's similarly unknown just how much information these companies are collecting on kids, including whether or not they're tracking their travels online. There is at least one federal law on the books that seeks to protect the privacy of minors online, but some of these new marketing techniques are so new that they might not fall under the rubric of existing law. In April, the Federal Trade Commission launched an inquiry into the practices of food marketing to children. The sponsors of this latest research, which include American University, the Center for Digital Democracy, and Children Now, are imploring the FTC to press food and beverage companies to become more transparent about their digital marketing practices and pay special attention to the effects these efforts have on kids' privacy and nutritional health. You've been listening to Media Minutes, a joint production of the Illinois Initiative for Media Policy Research at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization dedicated to media democracy. For more information, visit our website at freepress.net.
Okie dokie, welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today in WILL AM 580 from beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Today's program we have as our guest a person who's joined us several times in the past, and we're very fortunate and privileged to have her join us today. Our guest is Barbara Ehrenreich, author of several books, including the highly acclaimed Nickel and Dimed, as well as Bait and Switch, both of which she talked about on this program earlier. And now her new book, which has come out, Dancing in the Streets, A History of Collective Joy, published by Metropolitan Books. One of the privileges of my job here is that I get to read books like this so I can conduct interviews, and this book was a real eye-opener for me. Barbara Ehrenreich, welcome to Media Matters.
Nice to be with you again, Bob.
Yes, indeed. You know, when I first heard about this book, I said, this is sort of an interesting sort of sideways turn for Barbara to take based on your recent work on Nickel and Dimed and Bait and Switch and your active work dealing with inequality in our society and poverty. And then when I got to the end of the book, or towards the end, as I was reading it, it became very clear to me and focused why you wrote it. But tell our listeners, what was your motivation for doing this book? And, you know, what is the book basically about as you see it?
Well, I should explain first that this book was started over 10 years ago, about then. So it isn't like I did Nickel and Dime, Bait and Switch, and I said, oh, let's just switch to something different. Mm-hmm. This is 10 years worth of research, as you can tell from the length of the bibliography. And
it's quite impressive.
Yes, thank you. And the questions that led to this grew out of an earlier book, Blood Rights, on the origins and of war, the origins and history of the passions of war. And that led me into a lot of questions about what bonds humans together. Why are we so intensely social? What are the possibilities in that? You know, I think there's often a tendency for a certain kind of, what should we call it, pop evolutionary theory to say that we are by nature very selfish, greedy. But that's, you know, there's certainly some of that. But the astonishing thing about humans is that we are very, very social, more so than any other primate. And in Blood Rights, I looked at the bad side of that, how we can get whipped up against a common enemy and very much bonded to each other against a common enemy. And in this book, I was struck by the more wonderful possibilities of that bonding, which seemed to me or very clearly evidenced in the ancient, well, prehistoric even, a human tradition of festivities and ecstatic rituals that generate joy. The kind of joy that is not about sex, it's not about selfishness, it's something that really scholars have not paid that much attention to.
Barbara Ehrenreich, when I was explaining what your book was about to a friend of mine a couple of days ago, almost before I finished the first or second sentence, they looked at me quizzically and sort of instinctively said, you know, what about Nuremberg? What about mobs? What about the sort of irrational frenzies. This, you know, that this just seemed like such an unusual argument for someone to be making.
Yes, I got that response years ago when I started working on this from a friend who was a social scientist saying, oh, collective joy, isn't that dangerous? You know, which is like looking at romantic relations or sexual relations between two people and saying, well, what about rape, you know? A lot of things that can go wrong between two people.
Mm-hmm.
But this book is not about everything crowds of people can do.
Mm-hmm.
Some of those things are not so great, you know, lynch mobs, et cetera. But I'm, you know, you did mention Nuremberg. There's a whole chapter on the book, in the book on the Nazi and the Italian fascist rallies, which were meant to generate very strong kinds of feelings, but are very different from the kind of tradition I'm talking of participatory rituals and festivities. You know, when the spectators at Nuremberg were simply that, spectators. They stood along the edge of the road, the street, while soldiers marched by. At night, they stood in huge crowds and listened to one speaker after another. This is being an audience, not being a participant in some kind of collective activity.
In your book, what you do, and the subtitle, so people understand the title, Waltz Dancing in the Streets, the subtitle is A History of Collective Joy. And you go into, indeed, the history, even the prehistory. I mean, what I really, one of the things I most enjoyed about this book was the anthropology, going into sort of the origins of dancing, of collective activities as sort of a defining feature of our evolution. That's sort of really deep wired into a similar almost to language in defining us as a species. And could you just elaborate on that a little bit? I don't want to hear radio dials going off all over America because I'm very interested in this and I know you are. But I do think it really gets at something core to your argument about, you know, what makes people tick.
Yeah, well, the idea coming from evolutionary biologists is that a crucial thing in human evolution is that our ancestors were able to form groups larger than family groups, bigger groups, which were essential for collective defense against predators, against maybe marauding other bands of humans. Now, how do you form that group? Well, language helps, but probably much more important, and this is not just coming from me, but from evolutionary biologists, was this ability to create music, to dance together, to generate excitement and fun together. You know, that as one neuroscientist has put it, dance is the biotechnology of group formation. This is what really deeply bonded those human groups.
Our guest today, Barbara Ehrenreich, author of the brand new book, Dancing in the Streets, A History of Collective Joy, just published by Metropolitan Books. We're discussing the book on the air today live. If you'd like to call in with a question or comment for Barbara Ehrenreich, the telephone number here at WILL AM 580, 333-9455, our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. You know, Barbara, when I'm reading the book, and, you know, you present this history in there, and I want to talk about it during the show today, you know, what's striking, you point out, is that it's only in recent times that this human capacity for collective joy or ecstasy, celebration, has become something marginalized, disparaged, and so it seems foreign to a modern reader in a way, or bizarre, rather than natural.
Yes. Our culture is the product of many centuries of repression of these sorts of festivities and collective rituals. You can go back to ancient Rome to find very active repression. The ancient Romans stamped out the danced worship of the god Dionysus in 186 B.C. They really didn't think that was suitable behavior for a Roman citizen, especially not a male. And, you know, you find more and more of this sort of repression, countered by people bringing it back all the time until, you know, what a crucial turning point again would be the Protestant Reformation, the Calvinists, especially, were real killjoys. out went dance, out went costuming, out went drinking, anything else. And Sundays, the one day off, was supposed to be dedicated to sitting on a hard pew and listening to long sermons.
You know, a lot of the book deals with the Reformation and the emergence of capitalism. I think you really bring back Max Weber to some extent and draw on him along with other scholars, but his argument about the important linkages there, and they both play a direct role in sort of discouraging collective joy, dancing, festivals, carnivals, looking at them highly suspiciously. It's a large part of the book, and I thought one of the most interesting parts of the book by far. But before we talk about that, let's just back up and talk a little bit more about Christianity, its origins, because the book also, you go through the birth of Christianity and its relationship to carnivals, festivals, collective demonstrations of joy by people. And Christianity was sort of a mixed bag, wasn't it, with regard to this phenomenon?
Yes, there's plenty of reason to think that initially Christianity was something of a danced religion, that circle dances around an altar were part of the standard liturgy. Also, there was a feast involved among the early Christians, not just communion, little wafer or something like that, but a real meal, and that was actually quite an attraction to your low-income people, the fact that there was food and then that there was song and dance. Now, by the 4th century A.D., church fathers are really looking down on this sort of behavior and saying, well, this is immodest, this is not right, you should just stand still and, listen, be passive. But it took them a long time to get people, and this is within Europe now, out of the habit of dancing in churches. By the late Middle Ages, you have many more orders coming down from the church hierarchy trying to stop people from dancing in the churches. People apparently thought that that's what you did to worship. In fact, there were no pews until about the 16th or 17th century. People milled around, and, obviously, from so many sources, they danced, too.
In Islam today, certainly in the Western mind, is seen as a religion that is, makes Calvinism look like a hedonist festival by comparison. But Islam was by no means always a religion without celebration. Is that true?
Well, you have to distinguish between Wahhabism, that particularly puritanical strain of Islam, which, has been most nationally represented by Saudi Arabia, and other forms of Islam. The sort of competing strand within Islam has always been Sufism, which does feature ecstatic aspects and celebrations and festivities and all sorts of things. And that is, of course, anathema to the Wahhabist Muslims who are, like the Taliban, for example, coming into power, and I think it was 1994 in Afghanistan, the first thing they turned against was the Sufist forms of worship, stamping that out.
This has been sort of, so far, Barbara Ehrenreich, we've been talking somewhat abstractly, and I think one of the nice things about your book is you go through descriptions of what the carnivals are like in various countries and in various historical periods to really put some body and substance behind our abstract points about collective joy. Maybe talk a little bit, one of the nice discussions of the book, I thought, was about Europe prior to capitalism, prior to the Reformation, and I guess what would be considered the late Middle Ages. 13th century, 14th century, is a period in which there was actually quite a bit of carnival life and festival life for the average, for the people.
When the church did succeed in driving dancing out of its premises and numerous other kinds of festive behavior, all these things went out into the streets in the form of carnival and outdoor festivities, which there were so many of, it's hard to imagine. Like every Saint's Day, in France, in the 14th century, one out of 4 days of the year was given over to one festivity or another. Meaning people didn't live to work. They work was something you got out of the way. essentially, so you could party and have a good time.
And what, so, were, and the parties, what were the parties like, Barbara?
What was it like?
Yeah, what was...
Oh, if only I could travel in time. Well, you know, there were different elements. Certainly there was always dancing and music. There was usually costuming and masking, maybe cross-dressing. It's interesting how much cross-dressing went on at carnivals in Europe and in other settings, too. In other words, you know, we're breaking down all the barriers. The other barrier, of course, is that of hierarchy and class, and people broke that by mocking the powerful at carnival. There might be a king of fools, who was a mockery of the real king. There would be men and women dressed up as priests and nuns and performing or acting out lewd sorts of behavior. That would be a sort of humor. There would also be, might be sports. There might be all kinds of other things going on at the same time. And this is not just one day. This could go on for many days.
Our guest is Barbara Ehrenreich. We're talking about her brand new book, Dancing in the Streets, just published by Metropolitan Books. If you'd like to call in with a question or comment for Barbara Ehrenreich, the number here at WILL AM 580 is 333-9455. Our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. The book goes through the history of collective joy from prehistoric times, from biological evolution of our species through to the present day. Much of the book deals with the 20th century, and I want to talk about that and what the implications and significance of the work is for us today. But I do want to go back to what a central turning point in the book now, which is, as we already talked about, Protestantism, Calvinism, and the emergence of capitalism, and this sort of incompatibility of both of them with that sort of culture you just described, of a Europe where people are commonly taking days to really party in a quite irreverent manner.
Yeah, well, that obviously couldn't go along with capitalist industrialization. There was a big effort documented by many wonderful social historians to discipline what had been a peasantry into an industrial working class. So you've got to get people out of that idea that you could have a good time most of the time and into the new idea of working 6 days a week, 12 hours a day. So that was, you know, one
reason. Sounds like a tough sell.
It was a tough sell. Yeah. You know, for example, in England, well into industrialization, the workers like to claim there was somebody called Saint Monday. Mm-hmm. So why didn't they show up for work on time on Monday? Well, actually, they were probably hungover. But they said, oh, well, we're just observing Saint Monday's day. But there's another reason which, you know, many have pointed that out, which I point out and is more original to this book, is that from the point of view of elites, carnivals and festivities on the part of the ordinary people had become threatening by the late Middle Ages. Very often, these festivities in the streets would be the stepping stone or the launching pad for an actual insurrection against elites, or just outbreaks of fighting between working class people like urban artisans and more, wealthier people. So that was another motivation, was this link to insurrection and uprisings.
And then, of course, there's our good friend Calvinism, which plays a large role in the book. And you carefully distinguish between variants of Protestantism, Luther's Protestantism, which was less hostile to collective joy and demonstrations and partying, and Calvin's version, which was, as I gather, diametrically opposed to it.
Yeah. Now, Luther, you know, although he liked his beer and he liked to dance at weddings and so on, he ended all the saints' days. Mm-hmm. So that, in a way, right there, took away the opportunities. But Calvin, of course, went much further. Life was not supposed to include happiness. You were supposed to be miserable because you didn't know what the fate of your soul would be, and you were supposed to just work all the time. So that was big step. We're still, that very much hangs over us today.
Absolutely. And before we get into today, Barbara, there's one chapter here I thought was really quite extraordinary, which dealt with what you call, I believe, the epidemic of melancholy, and one that also hangs over us very much today. And you link it up to, I think it's a powerful part of your book, you're linking it up to the decline of collective joy. Could you talk a little bit about that, please?
Yeah, I was struck with it by around the time of the Reformation in the 17th century. There seemed to be a lot of concern over what they called then melancholy. Doctors and ministers primarily writing about what's wrong, why so many suicides, why so many people who appear, you know, listless, unmotivated, depressed is the word we would use today. The famous book, The Anatomy of Melancholy by Robert Burton, was written in this time. And I thought there has to be some sort of connection here. In fact, Robert Burton makes a connection because he very much goes after the Calvinists and said, you know, we used to have a lot of festivities. We used to dance and frolic and costume and stuff. We don't do that anymore. That's part of the problem. You know, I think he was probably right, because there are cultures in the world that you can find, even some extent today, where ecstatic dancing, for example, is seen as a cure for what we might call melancholy, and used deliberately for that purpose. And we gave up that cure.
Mm-hmm.
And plus, of course, you have, you know, less of a sense of human connectedness without these festivities. And anomie, you know, is a big source of depression.
And depression is the contemporary term for melancholy, and certainly is widespread in our society today. I mean, do you think there is a linkage then today with dissatisfaction people find with their lives and the lack of connection that came through carnivals and collective dancing and partying?
I think so. And I don't know whether it's sort of causal in that you take those things away and our spirits sort of wither, or whether it's more that when you take those things away, we don't have a traditional cure for melancholy.
Mm-hmm. Our guest is Barbara Ehrenbreich. The book we're talking about, Dancing in the Streets, just published by Metropolitan Books. If you'd like to call in with a question or comment, the number here, 333-9455, toll-free, 1-800-222-9455. Let's go to the phone lines right now. Line 1, Champaign County, you're on the air with Barbara Ehrenbreich.
Hi. I'm interested in the sort of the evolution of your ideas, perhaps we should say it that way. I was very influenced by your Witches, Midwives, and Nurses books, and I know it's actually available in a new imprint, and for your own good, and sort of the idea of the what that all started and what you've, since you've been looking at these so-called medieval times, what do you think of some of the theses that were generated? I'm actually not remembering how... Well, anyway, that's enough of an opening gambit, I guess.
Yeah, there was actually a link that goes back all the way to research I did for Witches, Midwives, and Nurses. The subtitle is History of Women Healers. When I was working on that, I came across something that just fascinated me, which I had to sort of put aside, and that is the phenomenon of menadism, the worship in ancient Greece of the god Dionysus by women, in which these women would put down their domestic chores, run outdoors for days and nights of revelry in the forest or the mountains. And I said, wow, fascinating. I'll have to come back to that. But that's the only link there.
Caller, do you want to go on with the question? Well, it looks like we've lost our caller, Barbara, so we'll go on ourselves, and hopefully he can call back if he wants to follow up on that. Going to the 20th century, and looking at, you have discussions in there of the fascist spectacles and how the fascists, you know, skillfully generated some sort of the feeling that would come from that, but in your view, not as participants, but as being manipulated more. But, I mean, what is it that something like Nuremberg rally or the fascist rallies Mussolini held, which we know less about, but which were also quite striking, what were those like? What did they do for? What did they do to a person who was a participant in those?
Well, there are first-person accounts in which people describe feelings of uplift and, you know, merger with the mass, everybody beginning to be part of a, you know, Germany or Italy or whatever it was that they were bonding to. Strong feelings. It's a little hard to do research on that, though, because many people kind of modified their feelings after the fall of fascism, and were not so eager afterwards to talk about that. And also, if you read newspaper accounts from the time, which I did, you'll find that the newspapers were, in you know, possibly exaggerating the effects on people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to say, oh, a wave of ecstasy went through the crowd. Well, did it, or is that what the newspaper felt it had to say if it wanted to keep publishing in a fascist country?
One of the things as I was reading this, you made alluded to contemporary evangelical religion in the United States. And I was expecting at one point you would say this is also an effort to tap into those same sort of bonding, deep-seated bonding emotions that draw people together. But you said that, if I correct me if I'm wrong, that while it had an element of that, it really still had the stern Protestant message in there of individualism, hard work, self-denial.
Well, you have to distinguish. I mean, a lot of what we call fundamentalism, anyway, it has been kind of Calvinistic. I mean, Jerry Falwell represented that. I think Robertson more or less represents that. It's fire and brimstone. You will be damned if you don't, toe the line here. There's another strand, and that is usually Pentecostalist, which is somewhat ecstatic, which has music and physical motion in the services. And this, it's interesting. Pentecostalism arose in 1912 in Los Angeles, started by a black man, and was the first of the interracial, truly interracial Christian, I don't know whether if I say sect, that's rude, but
denomination maybe, yeah.
Denominations, yeah. And it, in addition to be shocking people by being interracial, it was shocking because it brought the instruments and the beat of secular music to the forefront of worship, things which had existed for a long time in certain forms of black worship. And we have a Pentecostalism is growing worldwide, and it very much builds on this human capacity for very profound feelings when we're united with music and the possibility of at least moving around, they're not necessarily dance within the Pentecostalist church.
Forgive my ignorance on this point, Barbara, but do the Pentecostals have the same sort of interest in secular politics that the Falwells and Robertsons have demonstrated?
Generally not, but there must be exceptions, so I've got to be careful here.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, a lot of the most vibrant forms of worship, Pentecostal worship, are in, you know, storefront churches. Participants are very poor people. That's the way Pentecostalism is spreading throughout Latin America. Very different from, just to throw out an example, a church like the McLean Bible Church in Virginia, which, you know, important right-wing senators go to, and which is quite political.
Our guest thing here. Yeah, that permeates the entire book, too. Our guest is Barbara Ehrenreich, author of the new book, Dancing in the Streets, just published by Metropolitan Books. We do have a couple callers waiting. If you want to join them, the phone number here is 333-9455, the toll-free number 1-800-222-9455. Let's go back to the phones right now. Line 1, Lombard, you're on the air with Barbara Ehrenreich.
Hi, good afternoon. I wanted to ask a question on an unrelated topic, but I was really glad to see, Ms. Ehrenreich, that you were involved in an effort to sort of organize independent professionals, and I wanted to just sort of see how that effort was going.
Oh, yes, thanks for bringing that up. That is, we're quite another channel in my life. This is United Professionals you're talking about, and this is an organization that grew out in some ways from my book, Bait and Switch, on not getting by in America. When I realized while researching that there's really nobody reaching out to or organizing all the people who are constantly being churned out of the white-collar workforce. So that's what we're trying to do, to be an advocacy organization and provide some services. And we're at unitedprofessionals.org. Please come and join.
Okay, let's go back to the phone lines. Now, line 4, Kankakee, Illinois. You're on the air with Barbara Ehrenreich.
Hi. Look, I want to kind of revisit a topic you talked about earlier about dance. And I want to know if you feel that, you may have said this, I might have missed it, but are you saying that dance is intrinsic to human nature? That it's something that people are sort of compelled to do because of evolutionary reasons?
I would say the capacity for it is. We're not compelled to do very much. Obviously, you know, we do have some choice. Even the sex drive, which is very strong, and we know that, is something that can be overridden if you choose abstinence or something. But, yes, I'm saying that we are hardwired for this experience of great joy mediated by music and dance. Mm-hmm. No other species is, by the way.
Right. Yeah, the uniqueness of human behavior is kind of what I'm interested in, and I think it's all based on our ability to empathize. I think it's unique to people. Does that ring true? I mean, can you?
I think it's connected, but not the same thing. I would say empathy involves an act of the imagination. You know, where I can say, I can imagine your situation and your pain, and act empathetically in response to that. But with the kind of bonding that goes on in danced rituals and in festivities, it's more immediate. It doesn't even require that act of imagination. You are actually moving your muscles synchronously with the music and with all the other people around you.
Yeah.
I'm not saying, you know, I didn't say compelled, but you know, probably you've also had the experience of watching that sort of thing and having to restrain yourself from joining in. You feel the pull. You feel the
crowd. A crowd at a concert.
Yeah.
It's the same behavior of Aboriginal dancing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's some of the same thing.
Okay, very good. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, caller. And in fact, that leads really to one of the chapters in the book, which deals with rock music and sort of the rock rebellion of the 1950s and 60s through to today, and how that relates to this need, this desire for collective joy. And as I was reading that, Barbara Ehrenreich, I was, you know, thinking that the 1960s have gotten beaten up quite a bit since then by people who said it was just about hedonism and people just sort of getting stoned and dancing and listening to loud music and not really serious about changing the world, and you know, that they just wanted to have fun. And after reading your book, I sort of put that in a new light. Maybe they were onto something more in the 1960s than we thought.
Well, I was there. I was actually there. And I was one of the more sort of political people, you know, the more, almost Calvinistic. What are we going to do to stop the war, to end racism, et cetera, et cetera? But we who were political activists, student activists, were enmeshed in this large counterculture, which had a real effect on us, you know, because it kind of said, look, anything is possible, and we can create, you know, amazing change. If you went to a rock concert or to some sort of happening, you could have the feeling of entering into a different world. This is what we want, we would think. A world where people behave peacefully and lovingly toward each other and are having a great time. it gave us this little glimpse of something utopian that, you know, doesn't easily boil down to policy recommendations or something dull like that.
You know, and also I think the point you make toward the end of the book that comes out to me is that, you know, this sort of Calvinist notion of social change that so many people in this country have, whatever their political views, but especially, I would say, among progressives or people on the left, that sort of this is serious business and that, you know, you have to sort of hunker down and change the world. And then once you've done that, then you're allowed to have fun. But having fun in the meantime detracts you from that your mission and your calling. And in a way, that's almost the death knell of any opportunity or chance to really change anything. Because if I remember in the 70s, when this sort of dark cloud came over, that was my generation. And I just saw how many people thought doing politics was no fun. It was just like such a drag. It was like doing your penance. It was nothing you'd want to do unless you were forced to at a certain point in time.
Yeah. Yes, I think so. But, you know, that's been changing. I'm very struck by the way protests have been sort of, well, carnivalized in just the last 7 or 8 years, that you see more and more of these elements of carnival at anti-war protests, certainly anti-globalization mm-hmm. protests, where there will be dancing in the streets, people bring their drums, people costume fantastically. And, of course, the press always says, oh, they're just having a party. They're just, you know, they're not serious. But that's part of seriousness, I think. You know, people are creative and want to bring their own creativity to these events and have a good time.
Our guest, Barbara Ehrenreich, we have phone lines open at 333-9455, or the toll-free line is now open at 1-800-222-9455. Let's go back to the phone lines now. Line one, Champagne, you're on the air with Barbara Ehrenreich.
Yeah, hi. I guess I had a fairly fortunate childhood. I am half Irish, so I grew up with the Irish. And, you know, the festive part, celebrating your birthday, how young you were and all, but the personal contacts. And I think I read recently some research that people have less and less friends in terms of contacts. So whether you want to comment on that.
People have fewer friends.
Apparently, the research said that. And this sort of ties in, I think, with the points you're making in the book about the common arguments of Bella from the 1980s and Putnam more recently, that people's social interaction in general are declining.
Yes, which is, you know, very disturbing. I think some of this is just the way our lives are structured. If you think of the amount of time people spend commuting, for example, alone in a car, and everybody else in every other car is sort of an enemy of yours, trying to get ahead of you or take a parking space. We don't, you know, or we work in cubicles. These kinds of isolation are built in, and we don't do enough to break out of that. We don't have enough opportunities to break out of it.
Barbara, one of the chapters in the book that follows the one on rock and roll, which I think will help me really get a strong sense, because I could relate to it, like with rock actually, was on sports. Sports is carnival. And the role sports plays for many people in providing that sort of connection and joy that they aren't getting elsewhere in their lives, that you know, is the collective joy that goes back, you know, tens of thousands of years. And you argue that not only sports played that role to some extent, it's playing that role in an increasing manner today.
Yeah, I'm not really at all interested in sports, but I'm very interested in sports fans. And there was a real change in sports fan behavior, probably starting in the 80s in this country, that where you start getting people costuming for games, you know, wearing team colors or cheese heads or Afro wigs or something. You find people also rock and roll started coming into the stadiums for all sports, mm-hmm. major sports, making it also the demand, adding music. Then you got something you could call the analog of dancing, which is the wave, and other things that people can do rhythmically together in English. Soccer fans have something, you know, synchro clapping, where they amazingly all synchronize and clap together. So, people have been sort of saying we're not just here for a spectacle. We also want to be participants. We want our own sort of carnival here. And I think it's fascinating that this has happened in sports. Of course, right now, you know, there's I don't feel too hopeful about it because the price of tickets to stadiums has gone up so much it's out of the reach of the blue-collar people who originally were carnivalizing sports events.
Also, I don't know if you've been to many games recently, but the game is basically a sporting event that punctuates a nonstop commercial for one product or another, or one promotion or another. So if you want to do your carnival thing, you have to beat away many decibels of commercialism.
Oh.
Yeah.
No, that's true on TV. I didn't know if it was true in the flesh.
No, it's worse in the flesh.
Oh, my God.
Oh, yeah. Our guest, Barbara Ehrenreich, author of the new book, Dancing the Streets. You've only got about 10 or 15 minutes left, so please do call in if you have any questions. Barbara, I do want to, if we can, just talk a little bit about politics in America today. You're one, in my view, one of the most perceptive critics and observers of the political scene. What is your sense of where things stand in this country today? I mean, you're a veteran now, I think it's safe to say, of 5 decades of being politically active. How do you see things changing, if you do? Do you see any trends? I mean, are there sources of optimism for you or pessimism? Just give us the benefit of your experience to sort of give us a sense of how you see things going in this country today.
Wow, that's a big question, Bob. I should throw that back at you. Well, I'm obviously pretty optimistic. The Republican Party seems to be tearing itself to bits. I wish the Democrats, of course, were a little more stalwart and together. But, you know, this is certainly a much better time than 1 year ago. You know, there's a strong majority against the war. And I think that majority just has to be mobilized enough so the Democrats can't go soft on us.
Have you been following the presidential race at all in the media over the past few months?
Somewhat. I'm not a big electoral politics maven, though.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, I feel best represented, I think, by John Edwards because of his very strong and clear positions on the economic issues that affect both the middle class and the working class.
Our guest is Barbara Ehrenreich. We've been talking to all this hour about her new book, Dancing in the Streets, and now turning to other issues if people wish to talk about them. We do have time to take another caller or two at 333-9455. Toll-free line open at 1-800-222-9455. Line 2, Champagne, you're on the air with Barbara Ehrenreich.
Yes, thank you. The carnivalization of protest, I think, it's somewhat older than you're suggesting. I certainly remember that the Yippies brought, street theater into the politics of protest, and I remember a number of things that Abby Hoffman and others did. And also there was a tradition of this in Europe, and I have a book called Engineers of the Imagination that, a number of working class protesters and theater type people brought and actually set up carnivals in part of the protest, and this is something that's been going on for a while, but I think it is catching on more. You may be familiar with a group out of Minnesota, the Bread and Puppet Theater. They've been doing this for a long time.
Out of Minnesota, I thought they were San Francisco.
Well, I remember them at a Cinco de Mayo parade in Minneapolis. Maybe they'd come there for that. They had took over a warehouse there. I kind of got the impression that they were based there, but maybe that is true, that they were from San Francisco.
Yeah. No, you're absolutely right. In fact, carnivals in the Middle Ages, late Middle Ages, often turned in to insurrections. Same is true of slave rebellions in the Caribbean in the 19th century. Carnival was often a cover for them, for those rebellions. So, yeah, this is an old, old history. I was just thinking more short-term about a lot of our big protests in the 60s were quite somber. yes, there were the yippies, but, you know, I marched in a lot of those anti-war marches, and we didn't dress up. We didn't have drums. You know, we were trying to express our seriousness, which is often important to do. But, it, you know, there wasn't a lot of attention to can we have a great time doing it.
Our guest is Barbara Ehrenreich. Let's go back to the phone lines right now. Line 4 from a cell phone. You're on the air with Barbara Ehrenreich.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I am a Pentecostal Protestant believer, and I enjoy the liberty of the dance and the festivity and the tambourine and freedom of worship. And when I study the Word of God, do you agree that there is a great cloud of scriptures that support in the Hebrew people themselves in the Old Testament the gaiety, the dance, the tambourine, the freedom of worship? And I'll hang up and listen to your answer.
Yes, I think so. I mean, I was talking about the dancing, probably even ecstatic dancing in the early Christian churches. You go back to the Hebrews and the Old Testament, absolutely. You remember King David dancing down in the, through the streets of Jerusalem to celebrate victory. There, you know, there are so many examples from the ancient world. So I think that the, you know, Pentecostals have tapped into something that is, in fact, extremely traditional within the whole Judeo-Christian history.
Barbara Ehrenreich, you know, I just want to close with a story I had and ask for your thoughts on it. About 10 years ago, I was meeting with a bunch of progressive political organizers in Los Angeles, and one of them told an interesting story. She had attended a Promise Keepers meeting. This is a group of evangelical Christians, all men, if I'm not mistaken. Organized by a former football coach from the University of Colorado. And during this period, I don't know if they're still doing it, they were having a series of large stadiums almost filled with men.
They've run out of steam. They don't exist anymore.
Okay. Well, in this period, they were, I guess, still in steam and doing quite these significant events. And she talked about how that she went to one of these, she attended one of these with a few people. A couple of them were sort of academic, intellectual leftists, and a couple of them were organizers like herself. And the organizers were all instantly entranced by what was going on and the sort of connection that they saw among this audience. And these were not, they weren't sharing the political views necessarily, but they were just struck with the bonding that's going on. And the intellectuals were all appalled. They were just thought, this is the, you know, Nuremberg Jr., the worst thing they'd ever seen. And she's just, and I, this came back to me as I was reading your book, because it was just this, she just saw the striking split between the organizers and the intellectuals on this issue. And, you know, if you were talking to that those four people, knowing what you know now about collective joy, and writing about how important it was for progressive politics throughout our history, and how its absence has been, I think you chronicle fairly well the death knell for progressive politics in many cases. What would you say? I mean, how would you say to them?
I would say that the success of movements for social change from below really depends on one thing: solidarity. People being able to bond together and sustain those bonds through adversity and against terrible obstacles. Solidarity is a great old, you know, labor term. And good organizers know that you're not going to win your union organizing drive or your whatever you're doing unless you can generate those bonds of solidarity among people.
Our guest is Barbara Ehrenreich today in Media Matters. Next week in New Media Matters, our guest will be John Pilger, the journalist. The following week, Connie Schultz, another journalist, this one a Pulitzer Prize winner. And the week after that, we'll be talking with Professor Lance Bennett about his brand new book on media and the state of news today. Barbara Ehrenreich, what is your media diet? What do you refer to? What do you use to stay on top of the world?
Well, that, you know, certainly has been changed by the internet. I read the New York Times every day. I subscribe to a number of magazines, including the Progressive, and then actually some science magazines, because I like to keep up with that. And then when I'm researching something, you know, I'm a Google head.
Mm-hmm. What has the response been to your book so far? And it's been out now, I got my copy, I think, in February, if I'm not mistaken, or January.
Yeah, it's about that long. I haven't seen widespread outbreaks of dancing in the streets, but any day now.
What projects are you working on in the coming months or year?
Well, at this very moment, I'm trying to figure out a blog on the new immigration bill, and I am working on a book about what I call the cult of cheerfulness, the apparent, you know, a requirement in America that everybody put on a smiley face, have a positive attitude, and accept whatever comes to them. Of course, I see this as a major obstacle to organizing, too.
No, it's funny you should mention that because my wife's Norwegian, and her parents first came here, being, of course, raised in a dour Lutheran country. You know, they were just struck by, you know, every time at a fast food restaurant or wherever they'd be, people were, you know, asking them how they were doing and smiling. And it did seem strange to them that someone in that sort of position would take an interest in their well-being.
Well, the employees are required to. It's not exactly coming from just a overflowing good spirits. You know, you can lose your job. People routinely lose their jobs for having the wrong attitude, no matter what their skills or experience are. This is something I'm going after now.
So, I mean, if I can put the two together, the projects is an outgrowth of the current book, Dancing in the Streets. Dancing in the Streets is about a genuine joy, a genuine common bond and sharing with people. And the next book is about a bogus derivative thereof that gives us...
We're required to act. It's a performance. There's something wrong with you if you're not smiling and evincing a positive attitude at all times.
Does that go with the idea that Americans are averse to, you know, controversial discussions about issues like politics or religion for fear that they might upset someone?
Well, it wouldn't be very positive to talk about something real, would it?
You know?
No. Yeah, I think it's connected to that.
Barbara Ehrenreich, our guest, author of Dancing in the Streets, the new book that has come to us from Metropolitan Books, A History of Collective Joy, is the subtitle. This is a book that, Barbara, I really enjoyed reading. It had a lot in there that I wasn't really aware of. And the one issue that came up to me, and we've only got about a minute left, so I don't know if we've got time to really get into it, but and I mentioned it in the context of sports, but it also goes to rock music. How does commercialization of carnival-type events affect the nature of those events?
Well, I think it can be a very drastic effect. I saw it in one kind of local carnival. I used to live in Key West, which has an annual fantasy fest, a festivity in the streets. Used to be a very creative thing. People spend months on their dance steps and their costumes. Then a few years ago, I don't know exactly when, Budweiser took over the sponsorship. And the last time I went to it, I didn't stay long. It was mostly about people not costuming, but taking off their clothes and getting so drunk that they were barfing in the streets. it can completely drain the creativity and the spontaneity out of it.
I mean, in a way, the way you describe these collective joy events, they're almost antithetical. I mean, the purposes of commercialism and of carnival.
Yeah. I mean, carnival, as Goethe famously said, is something that people give to themselves, which is very different than something that is brought to you by Budweiser or whoever.
On that note, Barbara Ehrenreich, I think I hear the band tuning up in the background. We've got to take off. I want to thank you so much, Barbara, for being our guest today.
Well, it's always nice talking to you.
And good luck with the book Dancing in the Streets. My name is Bob McChesney. Thank you, listeners. And I want to thank my producer, Andrew Boyle, for a terrific job, as always, back in 167 hours.